doesn't have a quit yet. Everybody has a quiz? So start the quiz. That is now going to be the official clock up there, 1:32, so you have until 2:02:09. Then, well, whatever. Let's start the 2:02.
Sorry, there should be 4 pages on your quiz, so if you have less than 4 pages, let me know. I'll give you a full quiz.
3 minutes left.
Okay, time is up. Please hand your quizzes in towards the end of each row. Time is up. Please stop writing. Time is up. Time is up. Thank you. Time is up. Please either hand your quizzes in or bring them to the front, but any more quizzes back here? No more quizzes out here, right? We'll start back up in 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any more quizzes out here? Okay, folks, let's get settled in.
Don't talk about it. No. Let it go. Okay, so... I could make it 800, but the numbers would have been too big. Okay, folks. The usual as... Okay, so
here, oh, these are in
that's blank. That's the blank. You can throw this away.
Thank you, yeah, Professor.
Thank you so much. My office is open if you want to leave it on my desk. Okay, folks. Okay, so here's... So here's what's going to happen. You guys done? You do know there were two quizzes, right? So from corporate finance, you do realize there are two quizzes. So if you're talking about Argentina and your neighbor's talking about Chile, there's a good reason for that. You didn't misread the country, just two different quizzes. So that's no secret. But here's what's going to happen. You kind of know the sequence, but I'll go through it. The quizzes are getting sorted. Luisa and Nofal are going to sort the quizzes alphabetically while the class is going on. Hopefully, by the time I get back to my office at 2:50, the quizzes will be alphabetically sorted on my desk. And I will start grading. I have only like 20 minutes before my next class, but then I'll continue grading till I can't grade anymore, or I run through the quizzes. Hopefully the latter will come earlier than the former. Once I'm done grading the quizzes, I will record the quizzes in my own Excel spreadsheet, and then and only then will I post the solutions for the quiz online. And here's why. If I post it right now, you're going to be checking the solutions right after the class ends, and you're going to be freaking out in ways I don't want you to freak out. So I didn't get that answer. Oh, my God, I'm going to get a zero. Okay? You got to trust me on this one, right? If you got 90% of the problem right, I should be giving you much of the credit. So I will grade the quizzes, I will record them, and then I'll put the solutions up, and then you will get an email saying, come and get them. It'll be like a cattle call. And essentially, the quizzes will be face down on the ninth floor, not in my office, but right as you get off the elevator to the right. So there'll be three stacks, alphabetically, neatly sorted alphabetically, and I emphasize that. And I would like you to leave them that way. Just pick your own quiz. Don't check out other people's grades. It's none of your damn business. It's face down anyway. You've got to really try to look at a grade. So take your quiz and then check it against the solution because I'll give you a grading template and check to make sure I haven't been unfair to you. If I've been overly fair, I don't think you're going to bring it to my attention. So I think there's going to be a one-way street where you say, look, you missed this. Bring it in. Don't bitch and moan and stew in your own juices for the rest of eternity. I will screw up sometime this evening. Usually when I'm reading the Yankee news and I hear Aaron Judge has this undisclosed problem, it's going to piss me off. And the next quiz I grade, God only knows how I will grade it. So if I mess up on a quiz, just bring it in. I'll fix it. It's easily fixable. And tomorrow, I'll make sure the grades get put into NYU classes. Why NYU classes? Because then after the third quiz, if you don't even remember what you got in the first two, you don't have to come to me. It will be there. So the NYU class is more so that you can see your accumulating grades in case you forget. So that's pretty much it. So I thought I was extraordinarily fair, which is a nice way of saying I thought it was a pretty straightforward quiz. There are so many twists we could have had. Just a couple of things. One is you notice on problem three, on problem one, I did not give you an inflation rate for the US, but I gave you a way of getting there, right? Which is? I gave you the T-bond and the TIPS rate. On problem two, it was just remembering that there were two countries involved and making sure that you kept track of the currency you were working in, which was in zloty, so you need a risk-free rate in zlotys and the equity risk premium based on where you get your revenues. Problem three, I gave you two businesses, and they both had no debt. That's why I didn't specify what beta. In fact, I could have really played games with your mind and called it a levered beta, in which case you're saying, what am I levering for? So I was actually being nice by not giving it a name, because that way, you know, you have no debt, the levered beta is the unlevered beta. And then, of course, you have a merger or an acquisition. You're going to have a combined firm, so you weight based on the values of the businesses. And the only twist was you borrowed money to do half for half the acquisition. So that can affect your debt-to-equity ratio after the deal. So with those kinds of problems, it's always better to do the unlevered beta first and then bring in the leverage, because you try to deal with both at the same time, all kinds of weird stuff will happen. And problem four was a gimme with one twist, which is I gave you the free cash flow to the firm, and I gave you the financials. All you need to do is figure out what your after-tax operating income is, right? EBIT times 1 minus T. I gave you the EBIT. So all you had to figure out was the T, right? And what's the only thing you cannot do? There's no working capital to worry about, no CapEx, no depreciation. It's what tax rate to use. You cannot take the taxes paid and divide by EBIT. Tell me why again, because it's a good time to make sure. Even if you made that mistake, we get it out of the way. Sunk costs, get it out of the way. Why can't I do that? Because then I'm double counting the interest tax benefit, right? With the taxes, so I have interest expenses. My taxes are going to be lower. But if I count that as part of my free cash flow to the firm and then discount back at a cost of capital that incorporates an after-tax cost of debt, I double count it. So all you have to do is compute the tax rate from the financials, which will be the taxes paid divided by the taxable income. Apply the tax rate to your EBIT, and the rest, as they say, is a slam dunk, right? You get the after-tax EBIT, you get the free cash flow of the firm. What separates the two? Net CapEx, change in working capital. I can call it whatever I want, but it's all reinvestment, right? So it's just the difference between those two numbers. After-tax EBIT and free cash flow of the firm is your... So if you went looking for working capital, God help you. How did he even find it? Or depreciation or CapEx, it's not there. But my point is you don't need any of that stuff if you know the after-tax EBIT and the free cash flow of the firm. Something to remember, the next DCF you look at, don't get distracted by all the line items. Just look at those two line items. You're going to get a sense of what's being reinvested back. So let's now talk about growth. I know you're in no mood to even think about growth, but let's talk about growth anyway. Last session, we talked about historical growth. And we already established two things. One is it's not a fact. It's a function of judgments you make about how far back to go, what metric you're looking at, arithmetic or geometric. The reason I emphasize that is when you ask me what the growth rate is for my company and I give you a number, it's your job to ask me the follow-up questions to make sure that I'm not pulling wool over your eyes. It's also not that useful. Why it's not a good predictor of future growth? And I opened the door of, hey, maybe we can trust experts, and I'm using the word quote, experts, you know, here, to tell us what the growth rate is. Because the reality is when you're valuing a company, you're just starting to understand the company. You're reading about, and there are people out there, equity research analysts, whose life it is to just look after what's happening in these companies. Because the way sell-side equity research is structured, in my view, is very unhealthy. You're a sell-side equity research analyst. First, you work for an investment bank. The difference between buy-side and sell-side is buy-side, you work for a mutual fund like Fidelity, and you feed your whatever your assessments are to portfolio managers. Sell-side, you basically turn out research. So when you see that Morgan Stanley raised its pricing for Tesla, or the target price. That's a sell-side analyst. So sell-side analysts are the ones you read about, you hear about. No. So you're a sell-side analyst. Here's what happens. You get hired by, let's say, an investment bank, Goldman Sachs, as a sell-side equity research analyst. You're given a sector, 15 companies, and you're told for the rest of your life, just look at these 15 companies. Already the depressing rest of your life is starting to unfold. So if you're the steel company analyst, you look at these 15 steel companies over and over again. So you spend a lot of time looking at these companies. So let's face it. The steel company analyst has a lot more in-depth knowledge than you and I do. So when you're sitting down to value a steel company, you're saying, maybe I should just look up what analysts are projecting as growth for my company. And you can look it up on Yahoo Finance. You can look it up on Capital IQ. Lots of sources here. It's public information. So I want to focus on analyst growth rates. And given how much they bring to the table, ask, how much better are those estimates of growth rate than just using time series models? You know what a time series model does? It takes past earnings, projects based on that. So let's take a look at what the evidence shows on the quality of analyst forecasts. Analyst forecast growth, presumably with all this additional information, access to management, their growth rate should be a lot more precise than what you're getting from looking at time series. And one way to see test that proposition is to look at the earnings announcements that come out and compare them to the prediction that analysts make and the prediction you'd have got with a pure time series model. So if analysts are really, really good at predicting growth, then the error you make on that, the difference between the actual earnings and the predicted earnings should be small. So here's what the studies that looked at this phenomenon find. They find, the good news for analysts, is they find that analyst forecasts are better than time series models. Thank God for small blessings. All that work does provide better forecasts of earnings one quarter ahead. So if you ask me what the next quarter's earnings are going to be, and I use just past earnings and I give you predicted earnings, that number tends to be less precise than looking up what the analysts collectively are predicting for earnings, but not by much. In fact, take a look at the difference, right? So first, the good news is you can see the error for analyst forecasts is smaller than time series models, but it's by 3, 4, 5%. That's a lot of money we're spending on sell-side equity research with very little payoff. And that's with one quarter-ahead forecast. If you go to four-quarter-ahead forecasts or five-year forecasts, even that small improvement goes away. And that's a puzzle. You're saying, if you have all your time, you've done your research on the companies, you have access to the management, how come analyst forecasts of earnings are not better? A few years ago, I gave a talk for a symposium of sell-side equity research analysts. They haven't invited me back. And I threw this question out. You guys spend all your time with companies. You claim to have access to management. How come your forecasts are not better? You know what their answer was? Oh, our forecasts are really good. They're pulled down by these really bad equity research analysts who are out there. And that's the case, right? Maybe these studies look at the average equity research analyst, and maybe the average equity research analyst doesn't have that kind of access, is not that good. So maybe I should focus on the best of sell-side equity research analysts. And there's actually a subset of equity research analysts that get tarred as the best, or tarred is the wrong word, as labeled as the best of the group. They're called the All-America Analyst Team. And they draw from football. Basically what they do is they go sector by sector, and they will name All-America Analyst for this year is so-and-so from Morgan Stanley. All-America Analyst for Telecom is. So if you make it to that list, you've reached the pinnacle of sell-side equity research. Because once you're labeled an All-America Analyst, it becomes part of your name. You go around and introduce yourself, I'm John Williams, All-America Analyst. Okay? And there's a reason it becomes part of your name, because you're now labeled as the best. So maybe their forecasts are better. So I pulled up a study that looked at All-America analysts to see if their forecasts were much more better than the average analysts. And the studies actually find something very strange. They find that All-America analysts are actually a little worse than the average analysts the year before they get picked as All-America analysts, which already tells you that the way you get picked as an All-America analyst has nothing to do with the precision of your forecast, and everything to do with how your profile is. People recognize your name, they vote for you. But magically, the year after they get picked as All-America analysts, They go from being a little worse than the average analyst to a little better. What do you think happens? Maybe it's self-esteem rising, making them better analysts. What do you think is causing this improvement in forecasting? Trust shows up in stock prices. Trust can't show up in your forecast. So if you ask me why is the stock price effect greater, I can understand you have a bigger impact. But forecasting is about getting the earnings number right, right? Well, they could have done that before they were picked as All-America analysts, so why would they become a little better at doing that after they become All-America analysts? You're right, consensus kind of drives the herd, but why do they get a little better at getting close to the herd? Yeah.
Maybe the company kind of guides them down.
This is the big unspoken secret in sell-side equity research. It's not a secret. Technically, the SEC says companies cannot, in the U.S., it's actually very, very stringent, companies cannot selectively reveal information to equity research analysts. In fact, any information that companies give that is material information has to be available to all of the public. That might not be true in other countries. Maybe in other countries you can release it, but in the U.S. it's actually a pretty flat flip. That said, though, managers can give kind of this diffuse information. And surprisingly or not so surprising, the minute you become an All-America analyst, that access or that information seems to get better. So John Williams, just equity research analyst, called last year, and the CEO or the CFO didn't even take the call. Now John Williams, All-America analyst, calls. All of a sudden, the call's picked up and more information comes out. Actually, it gives you some insight into the potential improvement that you get from using analysts. The information almost by definition cannot be material information. It has to be this fuzzy information that still helps you on valuation, but not at the level of I can make money on it right away. Now, it is actually true that the effect of recommendations made by All-America analysts tends to be larger on stock prices than the typical analyst. And here, it's not even a question of trust. It's a question of having a megaphone. You're an All-America analyst. You have a high profile. If you put out an equity research report, you get that call from CNBC asking, will you be on for Fast Money? You work in Florida for a small equity research house. You're the sell-side equity research analyst. You might never get that call because CNBC doesn't even know you exist. Notice the same equity research analysts keep popping up over and over again on CNBC talking about the same companies. If you're Cathie Woods, it can't be the quality of your valuation gets you that, you know who Cathie Woods is. If you don't know, go look it up on Safari. She's been a big Tesla bull, and she's made a lot of money on it, but it's got nothing to do with the quality of your analysis. But she's on like every week. If it's Tesla, Cathie Woods is on. So basically, when you look at All-America analysts, they are slightly better than the typical analysts, but more because they have more access to information. So I've been thinking about this for a long time, because quite a few of the people who have gone through this class are now sell-side equity research analysts, much as I've tried to talk them out of it. And some of you will end up as sell-side equity research analysts. And some of them are going through existential crises right now, saying, what am I doing with my life? To which my answer is, you should talk to a priest or a rabbi or somebody, not to me. No? But the question they're facing is, hey, I've been doing sell-side equity research now for 20 or 25 years, and I'm noticing that things are starting to melt down under me. I see five potential problems in sell-side equity research collectively. This is about the profession, that if they don't fix, sell-side equity research is going to continue to decline. The first is tunnel vision. Remember I said you get hired as a sell-side equity research analyst who follows steel company. What are you asked to do? Focus just on the 15 steel companies. Forget the rest of the world exists. This is not good practice in valuation to forget the rest of the world exists. But that's exactly what the kind of sectoring we do with equity research, and it makes you, it gives you tunnel vision. You talk to a telecom analyst. All the guy can talk about is telecom. You're saying, why should he think about the rest of the world? Because it's impeding on telecom. So if there is a disruption happening that doesn't show up right away, he's not even aware of it, or she's not even aware of it. So tunnel vision. The second is Somebody mentioned the herd mentality. Basically, you see sell-side equity research analysts move as a herd. So one person raises earnings forecast, everybody raises it. One person raises the target price for Tesla, everybody's on board. Why? Because it's safer to be with the herd. Because then if you're wrong, you can say everybody else did it. And that's a safe place to be if you're an equity research analyst. The third is a variation of what I call the Stockholm syndrome. Remember the Stockholm syndrome? Became, I think, chronicled in the 1970s. And what people discovered was when people were kidnapped, after a while they started identifying with the kidnappers rather than the people trying to rescue them. Must have been in Stockholm. I guess that's why it's called the Stockholm syndrome. You're saying, what's this got to do with sell-side equity research? If you think about sell-side equity research objectively, what's your job as an analyst? To ask tough questions of companies and make an assessment of, is this management doing a good job, so you can put a buy or a sell recommendation, right? That would be the job description you'd write if I told you what sell-side equity research analysts do. Somewhere along the way, that job description gets skewed, and there are some sell-side equity research analysts who are so in the tank that they think their job is to defend the company against all comers. Their job is to not assess the company, but to defend management, defend the company. Take a look at some Tesla analysts. They've basically gone over to the dark side. They're no longer analysts asking tough questions of the company. They're in there pushing the story. There's factor phobia. Pick up sell-side equity research reports. They run like 100 pages. What does it take you 100 pages to tell me what a company is worth? And then you start reading and you can see why. There'll be nice colored pictures and there'll be stories and stories with pictures. And somewhere along the way, they might throw in a number, but then they'll pull the number back and say, let's go back to the story. They'll do adjusted EBITDAs till the number gets positive. And finally, there is a problem with sell-side equity research that I think makes it very difficult to be independent. How does sell-side equity research make money for an investment bank? So if you have Goldman Sachs equity research, obviously you have dozens of analysts, people working in this department, costs you to run the department, right? They turn out these reports. How much do they charge for these reports? Nothing. They're actually given away to clients. So sell-side equity research has no revenue stream by itself. So you're saying, why would banks do it? Not because they're feeling compassionate, or because they want to do you a favor. They're hoping you will do something else with the bank that'll make the money, whether it's trading through the bank or using other services. Which means if you're a sell-side equity research analyst and you put out a recommendation to a company, the bank is looking at that recommendation saying, what will this do to the rest of the business we have with the company? You're a sell-side equity research analyst tracking Casper, and you're going to put out a sell recommendation. I don't know who the lead investment bank at Casper was, but let's say you work for that lead investment bank. I know there's supposed to be Chinese walls between sell-side equity research and the rest of the bank, but let's face it, these walls are full of holes. People climb up the wall, down the wall, they go around the wall. Some of them have doors in them. Some of them wall doesn't even exist. I guarantee you put out a sell recommendation in Casper, you are going to hear indirectly from someone saying, maybe you need to soften that recommendation. So that I call this the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde problem, which is you're not sure what job you're doing at any point in time. Are you doing sell-side equity research where you're assessing the company? Or are you a person trying to get investment banking business for the company? Until we fix those problems, I think it's unfair to put people in the sell-side equity research analyst job and say, be honest, give me an objective assessment, because the system is structured against it. So here's the bottom line, and I'm going to state these as propositions. First is, when I'm valuing a company, would I like to see what analysts are projecting for the company? Absolutely. I'd be stupid of me to say, I'm not even going to look. I want to see what analysts are forecasting, even if I think they're biased and because there is probably information that they should be assessing. Second proposition, that information is likely to be coming from the company. It can't be information coming from financials because I can compute ratios just as much well as an equity. So it's coming from the company, and therein lies a problem. The company is a biased source of information, right? So if you're an analyst, it's like being a journalist who has a politician as a source. That's nice that you have a source, but don't expect the politician to give you an objective assessment of what's going on. You're going to get a spin, and companies do the spin, and that spin is going to show up in the forecast. which is one reason all American analysts become magically better after they get chosen. And third, when you look at when you look at forecasting future growth, while it's good to know what the analysts are forecasting, you have to make your own assessments. It's still your story and your valuation. So some of you are going to be faced with this challenge. You're going to be sitting down to value a company. You're going to make a projection of growth for your company. And we'll talk about some of the ways you can come up with it. Let's say you come up with a 5% growth rate. Then you're going to open up IBES or Yahoo or Capital IQ, and you're going to see analysts projecting an 18% growth in earnings for the next 5 years for your company. And part of you is going to say, well, they've spent a lot more time with the company, so I'm going to change the 5 to 18. Not so fast. When you have a gap that big, you want to dig to see what you might have missed. So start with that. Second, remember, analysts forecast growth in earnings per share, not in revenues or in operating income. So if you're doing a revenue forecast, your growth rate should be... But before you jump, you want to make sure you are doing it for the right reason. That there's something you're learning about the company from that growth rate that you want to bring into your growth rates. Don't just try to put the analyst growth rate in there, because that's really not a valuation. That's a plug and chug. It's going to give you a number, but I'm not sure what that number means. Which brings me to my third and final way of thinking about growth. Ultimately, growth doesn't come from the past. It doesn't come from analysts. It comes from choices you make as a company. So to set this up, I'm going to go through a very simplistic example. So you have a company. Right now, it has $1 billion invested in projects on which it's making a 12% return. So right now, it's making $120 million in net income or earnings, whatever earnings are. Next year, it expects to invest $100 million in new projects and earn a 12% return on those new projects as well. So if you do the math, if their existing projects continue to earn 12%, you add another $100 million, then their earnings are going to be $132 million next year. So their earnings grow by $12 million. And if you think about why they're growing, it's because you've added new investments which are earning a 12% return. So in a world where returns are stable, the only way you can grow is to add to your invested capital base and earn a return on that base. In fact, if I took that $12 million and stated it as a percentage of the earnings, that's a 10% growth rate, right? And in fact, I can write that growth rate, the 10% growth rate, as a function of two things. One is how much of the $120 million I put back into the company. Remember, I invested $100 million. That's 83.33%. And what kind of return I make on that investment. Ultimately, growth algebraically comes from how much you reinvest and how well you reinvest. This is not a theory. It's not a hypothesis. It's a plain algebra. It is true that sometimes you can get a little more growth by improving your return on existing assets. In my example, if I take my existing assets, which are earning 12%, and make them earn 13%, I'm going to get growth. I'm going to call that efficiency growth. When you sit down to value a company, these are the questions you've got to ask. Is how much can my company grow? And maybe some of that growth can come from being more efficient, and some of it from investing more in projects. But you're asking the right questions now. Because now you're thinking about growth as being driven by the business you're in, the investment opportunities you have, and the returns you make on those investment opportunities. So one of the ways of thinking about growth is to try to estimate those two numbers. How much am I reinvesting? How well am I reinvesting? Now, the way I estimate it will be different depending on whether I'm looking at equity income or whether I'm looking at operating income. So I'm going to give you three variations of reinvestment and return. And I want you to think about what I'm doing in common and not get focused in on the actual mechanics. If you ask me to estimate growth in earnings per share, that's an equity number, right? I'm going to measure what I reinvest with a retention ratio. Remember what a retention ratio is? Payout ratio is what you pay out in dividends. Retention ratio is whatever you don't pay out, right? So retention ratio basically captures how much of your net income is going back into the business. How well you reinvest, I'm going to measure with your return on equity. Why? Because I'm equity focused. Net income divided by book value of equity. This is the only place in finance we use book values in computing accounting returns. Retention ratio times return equity is expected growth in earnings per share. That is it's called a sustainable growth equation. That equation's been used 50 or 60 years by old-time value investors. They're very fond of that equation. We'll talk about its pluses and its minuses. That's if I'm looking at per share numbers. per share numbers, the only way it can grow is by, you know, investing more of my net income. But if I'm looking at total net income, I'm opening the doors to growing much faster because I can now raise new equity and put it into the company. So there I'm going to measure how much you reinvest much more directly. Rather than trusting that whatever you put back into the company is being reinvested, I'm going to look at your net capex, including acquisitions and R&D. I'm going to look at your change in working capital. And because I'm equity focused, I'm going to allow you to tell me how much of that you raise from debt. So that comes from equity. Dividing that by net income gives me what's called an equity reinvestment rate. Retention ratio and equity reinvestment rate, right? We'll talk about what you get by moving from a retention ratio to an equity reinvestment rate, but you've given yourself more flexibility. You have more room to be different. And how much return I make, I'm going to focus on the portion of my net income that I'm invested in. Remember, if I have a lot of cash, what I have is book equity includes that cash. So I'm looking at what I call my non-cash return equity, what I make on my non-cash assets divided by book value. If I'm looking at the operating income, though, I have to define what I reinvest much more broadly. I'm no longer interested in how much of my net income I'm reinvesting. I'm looking at the percentage of my after-tax operating income. And that I'm going to capture by looking at net capex and change in working capital, because they're both reinvestment, as a percentage of after-tax operating income. If you ask me how good are my projects, rather than give you the return I make on my equity, now I'm going to give you a return on invested capital. What's invested capital? It's book value of equity plus book value of debt minus cash. It's what you have invested in operating assets. And in the numerator, I have after-tax operating income. It looks like three separate equations, but I'm asking the same question. How much are you reinvesting? How well are you reinvesting in different contexts? So let's take the easiest scenario first. Let's suppose I want growth in earnings per share. Growth in earnings per share is retention ratio times return equity. Okay? Now, retention ratios come with limits. What's the highest my retention ratio can be? 100%. I can't go above 100%, which actually gives you a very interesting conclusion. If you believe in this equation, what's the highest growth rate your company can have? The most you can have is a retention ratio of 1. The growth rate you can have as a company can never exceed your return equity. That can be a very depressing thought if you're a company with an 8% return equity, right? I've told you, you can never grow your earnings per share faster than 8%. You could grow your net income faster by issuing new equity, but your return equity acts as a cap. So when you're doing per share numbers, it's retention ratio times return equity. And I'll give you a very simplistic example of how you can use this. I use this ratio primarily when I'm doing banks or financial service companies where I'm still using the dividend discount model. Even there, I've kind of abandoned, but if I use the dividend discount model. So this was a Wells Fargo valuation I did in August of 2008, just before the crisis. Talk about bad timing, because every number you have basically melts down after the crisis. Right? Their return on equity was 17.56%. Why? Probably because they were creating fake accounts and doing whatever else, and now they're paying a fine for that. I mean, they were cutting corners, but at that time, we didn't know. 17.56% return equity. The retention ratio was 45.37%. That's a percentage. So the payout was 54.63%. The retention ratio is whatever left over. If you'd asked me in August of 2008 what the growth rate was, given that I did not know what was coming 1 month later, I'd have very casually taken the return equity and the retention ratio, multiplied them, and say, hey, you know what? The growth rate is going to be about 8% a year. It's a very simple way of computing growth, which is tied to what a company does. 2 months later, I revalued Wells Fargo. But what a 2 months that was, right? You had a crisis in the middle. The world was melting down. It was very clear that the regulators were now going to crack down on banks because banks had become the epicenter of this crisis. Why? Because they hadn't set aside enough capital to cover their losses. So let's say in October of 2008, you're looking at Wells Fargo. None of the numbers have been updated. The net income is still, because there have been no quarterly earnings announcements since before the crisis. So the numbers for net income that I had for Wells Fargo were exactly the numbers I had before the crisis. But let's say based on looking at the crisis, I felt that banks would be required to increase their regulatory capital by 30%. That's like saying your book value of equity is going to go up now because you've got to bring in fresh capital. Let's look at how the growth rate is going to change when a regulatory capital kicks in. The net income, I'm keeping the same, even though that might be unrealistic. But remember, my denominator now is going to be 30% larger because my book equity is going to go up. That lowers my return on equity, I think, from 17.3% to 14.5%. You can work out the actual math. Just divide 17.56 by 1.3. So my return equity has dropped to about 14%. Even if Wells Fargo pays exactly the same percentage of its earnings as dividends as it did before, same payout ratio, guess what's going to happen? Lower return equity, same retention ratio, I'm going to have a growth rate of about 6.5%. You say, what happened? Well, my base increased, I'm going to have a lower return equity, my growth comes down. It's a very simple way to bring in what you think will be regulatory changes into growth rates for banks and insurance companies. Because if that regulatory capital becomes more onerous, you've got to reinvest more, you're going to have lower return equity and lower growth rates. So very simple equation, but still a useful one to think about, hey, where does growth come from? So bottom line is, if I believe this equation, high return on equity is the key to having a high growth rate, right? I want a high return equity. And there are two ways you can end up with a high return equity. One is to go out and take better projects. That's how Google and Facebook and Apple end up with high returns on equity. Tremendous project, 25, 30. The other is to take average projects and lever up like crazy. Real estate people do this all the time, right? You take an 8% project, and if you take on enough debt, that 8% can become 18 or 28%. Now, let's pause right there and ask, if you're valuing a company and you see a high return equity, would you rather see a high return equity because of great projects, or would you rather see a high return equity because of the use of debt? And tell me how in a valuation that's going to show up, because the numbers are going to look the same, right? Same growth rate. It's kind of a variation of the question I asked about free cash flow equity. When you have a high return equity and you're levering up, then I'm going to punish you by giving you a much higher cost of equity. But that's something to remember, because when you break a return equity down, here's what you will get. There's a return on capital. Think of that as what your return equity would have been if you'd used all equity. And then there's a second term in the equation that tells you what the benefit is going to be to you as an equity investor of using debt. And the benefit, very simply, is the difference between your return on capital, which is what you're making on your projects pre-debt, minus what you pay on your debt after taxes. And the more debt you use, the higher the debt-to-equity ratio, the higher the return equity will be. So you can end up with a high return equity by borrowing a ton of money as long as the return you're making on your investments exceeds what you're paying on your debt. So I'll give you the kind of benign version of how this plays out. 1998, I valued a Brazilian company called Brahma. Since then, it's been renamed. It's now Ambev. So it's, you know. And I was astonished at the return equity, 31%. Yeah, this is really good. Let me see what's going on. They started with the return. I know you guys drink Brahma. You all look at each other. You know, come on. Now. That's your only exposure to Brahma. It's not as if you cared about the company, but the beer is really good. I get it, right? Yeah. So their return on capital is 19.91%. Let me pause right there. If they'd been an all-equity funded company, their return on equity would have been 19.91%. So you're saying, why is it 31%? Well, they had a debt-to-equity ratio of 77%. In book, and remember, this is one of those few cases where you're using book values for everything. So the book debt-to-equity was 77%. Their after-tax cost of debt was about 5.6%. You're making 19.91% on your project. You have a 5.61 cost of debt. As you borrow money, you get that jump in your return equity. Their return on capital is really good to begin with. So it's not the kind of company you're going to freak out, but you can somehow, when you sometimes decompose returns on equity for some companies, you can very quickly see that their return on capital is high single digits. That this is really a very average company that just looks good on an equity basis because they're using debt. You think, who cares? There will be bad times. And when those bad times happen, you're going to see the return equity swing very quickly to the other side. So it's a very simple link between debt and return equity. And many people jump to the conclusion then, if you borrow more, your return equity should go up. Well, not necessarily, right? It's a conditional statement. I grew up in a town in a city in South India called Chennai. So basically, it's been 40 years since I left, so I have very few connections other than my immediate family. But somehow people seem to find out when I'm coming and they decide it's a time for free consulting. Okay? So will you come in? And many of these people are people who I've known since I was a kid, so you can't exactly shut them out. I call India the original Facebook. Everybody knows everybody else, and you get pressure from every possible direction. So this was about, 15, 18 years ago, a long time ago. And an uncle of mine was the chairman of a board of directors for a pretty well-known Indian company called Titan Watches. And he called me before I came and said, can you come in and talk to our group? Because we're running into an issue. We've been using leverage because we want to increase our return equity, and we've been very good about using leverage. But we keep increasing leverage, and the return equity keeps going down. I said, okay, I'll look at the numbers. And you can probably see the problem. They had a return on capital of 9.5%. Remember, this is in Indian rupees 20 years ago. 9.5% looks good because you're thinking US dollar terms today. They had 9.5%. Their book debt to equity ratio was 191%. So he wasn't kidding when he said they were on the debt level like crazy. The after-tax cost of debt he was facing was 10.125%. I didn't even talk. I just went up and I put this equation up. And I said, guys, do you see a problem? But the problem is when you're focused on return equity and you're not even thinking about where it comes from, you can very quickly start to lose perspective and think about leverage is always improving return equity. So leverage improves return equity, but only if your projects, your investments are earning more than your after-tax cost. It's kind of a minimal requirement. Let's now move to kind of a more expanded version of growth. Remember I said retention ratios, the highest number you can get is 100%. What's the lowest number you can have for a retention ratio? Zero to 100. And that's going to be an issue because when you talk about overall net income, you could reinvest more than your net income back into the business. You think, how am I going to do that? You raise fresh equity. And you could end up with negative cash flows, which means that you could end up with... So basically, your equity reinvestment rate doesn't have the same constraints as a retention ratio. It can be higher than 100% or lower than 0%. So let's talk about estimating equity reinvestment. So basically, what you're focusing on is all of net income now, no longer per share. Your net income from non-cash assets will be net income minus the interest income you make on your cash assets, net of taxes. Your equity reinvestment rate is net capex plus change in working capital minus whatever debt you've used. Basically, it's the equity portion of that divided by net income. Your non-cash return equity is whatever you computed as net income from non-cash assets divided by book value of equity. So in a sense, it's more complicated than retention ratio and return equity, but you're trying to dig a little deeper. And here's why. When I tell you my retention ratio is 80%, what are you assuming? You're assuming I'm reinvesting 80% back into the company, right? But is that true? If I don't pay something out as dividends, is that money being reinvested? Not necessarily, right? You could be holding it as a cash balance, just sitting there. So what I'm looking at here is what are you actually investing? It's a much more honest measure of what you're putting back into the business. So here's how would it work out. I took a company that everybody's familiar with, Coca-Cola. Net income of $11.8 billion in 2010, book value of equity of $25,346 million. So basically, you can already see with just a rough estimation, that's almost a 40-something percent return equity. And that's before I adjust for cash. They had a cash balance of $7 billion, so that's in the $25 billion, on which they barely made any money. Why? Because it was in T-bills and commercial paper, $105 million. So when I compute my non-cash return equity, I'm taking the 11.809 million and subtracting out the interest income from cash. That gives me 11.7 billion. And I take the book value of equity and I net out the cash. I end up with a return on equity of 64%. Why is Coca-Cola's return equity so high? It's actually much higher than Pepsi's return equity. It's not actually the use of debt. It's actually something they did almost 35 years ago. Go ahead. But Pepsi has a brand value, so does Dr. Pepper, et cetera. The difference is about 40 years ago, what did they do, Gabe? The stock buybacks are a problem as well, but in 2010, they were not yet the problem they are today. They took their bottling, because if you think about a beverage company, the most capital intensive part of a beverage company is those bottling operations, the only manufacturing part, right? And about 40 years ago, Coca-Cola spun off their entire bottling business. And so that's why you have Coca-Cola and Coca-Cola bottlers. I've known people who bought the wrong company because they both called Coca-Cola. So I bought Coca-Cola, it's not going up. Everybody tells me it's going up. You bought the bottling business, which is a captive business in a terrible, you know, with a terrible business model. So what you have in Coca-Cola is a syrup, which costs absolutely nothing to make. No wonder the return equity is so high. And the way this plays out is even though they're reinvesting very little, if you look at the net capex and change, what are they reinvesting in, right? There's no bottling to invest in. Are they improving the syrup? That didn't work out that well in 1986, remember? New Coke, old Coke, new Coke. They've stopped even messing with the syrup because nobody really cares what the syrup tastes like. Their reinvestment is only 8%. Normally when you reinvest only 8% of your net income, your growth is going to be almost non-existent. They actually have a growth of 5.22%. Not bad for a company of their size because their return on equity is so stratospherically high. So earnings per share, just retention ratio times return equity. Nice thing about it, it's simple, but it's constrained. Net income, you want to expand the definition to include what they actually reinvest. You get an equity reinvestment rate, and you get a non-cash return equity. You're getting a much better sense of business models and how they're playing out. Leave you with one final page, and then we'll build on this next session. When I move from earnings per share to net income to operating income, I've got to be consistent. When I talk about operating income, my reinvestment rate now becomes how much of my after-tax operating income I put back into the business rather than the equity reinvestment rate, and how well I take projects is going to show up in my return on invested capital. ROIC is the most used and misused term in corporate finance and valuation. Now, people I walk around consulting, what's your ROIC? It's like an inside consulting, you don't know what ROIC is, get out of this room, you're not allowed in here. ROIC is a very simple accounting number, right? It's based on after-tax operating income in the numerator and invested capital in the denominator. You're trying to measure the company-wide level, are your projects good? You're saying, why would that answer be different than the return equity? Remember, with return equity, I can pump up your returns using debt. My ROIC is kind of insensitive to my debt because it's included in my calculation. So next session, I'm going to talk about reinvestment rates and returns on capital, and then I'm going to spend some time looking at this accounting number, return equity, return capital, and talk about some warning signs you should watch out for. So I will see you on Monday.
We have a quiz with no name anywhere.
Okay, folks. I have one quiz with no name. Did somebody just... Okay. So if you don't remember writing a name, come over here. If you do remember writing a name, just leave. Don't worry about it. First quiz is easy. Final exam, not so easy. I'll take it back up. You guys can go.
Yep. So is the idea that with the per share estimate of growth and the aggregated estimate of growth, they're going to be two different estimates of growth?
Yeah, because you can grow really fast, but if you keep raising equity and putting up, so or acquiring other companies. And so when you look at a high growth rate in net income, growth rates in net income can be made high because you keep raising capital and making your business bigger.
And
growth in earnings per share can't be high because of that, because the number of share count will also go.
And also because the difference between the two is that this one contemplates the
what you actually invest.
Cash.
Yeah, because it says, look, just because you're retaining money doesn't mean you're reinvesting.
Yeah.
You could be holding cash, in which case it doesn't help much in terms of growth. So it kind of is more focused on explicitly looking at what you reinvest.
Yeah.
And how you
invest. Okay.
Hi, Professor. I have a question related to the capitalization of R&D.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if we should capitalize all of the R&D in reality, since some of the expense to R&D might be in vain, such as some companies develop new drugs. It might take a very long time.
When was the last time when you did R&D on a new drug and you actually sold the new drug this year? I've never heard of a pharmaceutical company able to do that.
Thank you.
And it won't be called R&D. So basically, if you're working on a generic drug, there's no R&D involved. It's just came on production decisions. So could it happen? Yes. I've never seen it happen with a pharmaceutical company. Maybe with a software company. But remember there, the life is going to be short to begin with. So I don't see why it would be, because it's an average life. Some of your R&D might be in the next year or two. Some might be in 3, some might be in 5. So it might not, so I'm not sure it'll even change your numbers that much.
So in reality, people capitalize all of the R&D.
In reality, they expense all of it. I'm capitalizing it because I'm saying you should capitalize it. So what
I see is in China, some companies report part of the R&D which are capitalized on the financial reports.
What kinds
reports.
Of companies?
What I noticed is
technology companies?
Yeah.
In which case the life might be 1 year. Remember, your R&D pays off in 1 year and then you're done. Then you can use a 1 year life.
Like the Huawei, you know the yes. That company has the maybe the partial it's part
the
5G, of
the let's
capitalization yeah. is under 20%, I remember that.
I'm sorry, what is under 20%?
The portion of capitalization of R&D. I think it's under 20%.
So you're saying, is that what accountants do? Or is that what so when you say under 20%, is that what you would do looking at Huawei's R&D, or is it what the company does right now?
The company does.
So who cares, right? Accountants can do whatever they want. Right? So what difference does it make what they capitalize and what they expense? From a tax perspective, you want most of your R&D to be expensive. You let companies decide how much of the R&D should be capitalized. They're almost all. I'm surprised it's even 20%. I'm surprised the company doesn't say it's all R&D, it's all expense, and we get the benefits right away. From a tax perspective, that's the best thing you can do. So when you look at what companies